Greetings and welcome to the first podcast by Family for Every Child. Family for Every Child is a global network of 40 civil society organizations located in 36 different countries. We unite our skills and knowledge to achieve change for children and families worldwide. In episode one, our CEO, Amanda Griffith, leads a discussion on how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected our members, Family for Every Child's response to the current situation, and technical guidance developed by UNICEF, Better Care Network, and the Alliance for Child Protection in Humanitarian Settings. We also hear from four of our members from the UK, Bangladesh, Ethiopia, and India about the situation in their respective countries, how their organizations have adapted, and questions and answers from our audience.
So the focus of today is going to be on COVID-19 and our response to COVID-19. And what we're really aware of is that although the virus doesn't discriminate, certainly the impact is going to be extremely unequal. And as all of us already work with marginalized and disadvantaged communities, this is going to be incredibly important for us to understand what the situations are and what responses are needed. And we anticipate this is going to be threefold. First of all, with the virus itself, what we recognize the inequities that exist around this is that for many of the families and communities we work with, they aren't able to implement the prevention strategies that are advised. So for example, for many people living in settlements, they aren't able to implement social distancing since they live in very dense populations. They may not have access to clean water to be able to use regular hygiene facilities. They have access to poor information, and what we're hearing is actually quite a lot of disinformation and a certain amount of sort of scaremongering around what communities are carrying the illness. And also we know that in many countries they will have access to very weak healthcare systems. This is being further compounded by the fact that in many countries they are implementing a lockdown system, at least in some of the main cities. And that is leading to a loss of livelihoods, particularly for poorer communities who are on daily cash type earnings or in the informal sector. And in many economies, there's no financial safety net being put in place. Disturbingly, in each of the countries where lockdown has been imposed, there has been a significant increase in domestic violence, including an increase in the number of deaths of women. What we recognise is the importance of school food programmes. So with lockdown and the closure of schools, children who are in desperate need of the daily food allowances provided in schools are missing out, as well as, of course, missing out on education since they can't access distance learning or online educational facilities. And we're also aware of weakened social services systems in place, which may be leading to increased risk of child protection issues. And what we're hearing increasingly is there is going to be an economic downturn, which will be both long-term and global. And in fact, I know the World Food Programme has already now put out a report anticipating extensive famine. What we do know is there is an opportunity to learn from the Ebola crisis and the HIV/AIDS response. So we can be considering what from those experiences we can be learning to implement at this time. One of the things that we've already done is we've undertaken a survey with members, and this is an ongoing survey, so please feel free to update this so that we're getting a really in the moment intelligence of what is happening for our members and their communities. So the recent survey has shown us that in terms of the outcomes of the virus in communities, that there is a vast majority of the members are reporting challenges to the communities they work with related to access to basic needs, including food, hygiene and medical supplies, information and shelter. A lack of access to these supplies was linked to the impact on livelihoods, given that many parents are reportedly working in the informal and low-wage labour and are all unable to work. There's also concern relating to the care and protection of specific marginalised and at-risk groups, including children with a disability, street-connected children, children on the move, and Indigenous communities. Other vulnerable groups include single mothers and those in prison or detention due to confinement and a lack of protective measures. Issues related to children outside of adult care, such as street-connected children, include a lack of government response, a lack of access to shelter and basic needs, being penalised due to not having anywhere to go, and one member also reported cases of child abandonment. The impact for children in care situations varies. For some, the paralysed judicial system was impacting their cases and ability to have relationships with their families. In other contexts, the negative financial impact of COVID-19 on NGOs was raising concerns that the basic needs of children in care may be compromised. Some children were wanting to leave shelters while others are being rapidly reintegrated. There are also concerns for kinship and immune compromised carers. And finally, as I say, violence and abuse is another emerging area of concern. And this was related to gender-based and domestic violence, and also violent crackdowns by armed forces in some contexts. This links to issues of stigma and discrimination in some cases, and family separation in others. In terms of the impact on member organisations, all but three members indicated that they are adapting or expanding their existing services to respond to the pandemic, while seven are planning additional activities and three are already implementing new activities. Adaptations, expansions, new areas of work were often related to meeting both the basic and psychosocial needs of communities in the context of COVID-19 or distributing preventative information. Some members are also trying to ensure access to education. Unsurprisingly, many members are having to adapt their work to remote working models. Specific responses to children's care needs include rapid reintegration out of shelters by one member, increasing shelter space by others, including one who has started street outreach activities, and additional checks via a shelter task force to help protect children in residential care by another. The pandemic is also having a strong impact on staffing. Most significantly, some members are now operating on a skeleton staff, with staff taking leave or being let go. Members are also seeing a decline in their income, mostly related to fundraising opportunities drying up or changing. For some, there is also uncertainty in how existing grants will be affected, while the diversion of budgets into humanitarian aid is also proving challenging for others. Some members have also had to reduce or stop certain programs as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. In terms of the types of requests that have been identified by members, in terms with the Secretariat, they've looked for support them during COVID. The top ranked responses include resource sharing, enabling information exchange between members, implementing a fundraising campaign, and technical support. And members also overwhelmingly call for knowledge sharing of experience, approaches, practices, and initiatives relating to COVID-19 in order to help each other respond to communities and children's needs. Other specific areas relate to knowledge sharing, including ways of working, addressing digital divides and barriers to virtual working for different communities, supporting government responses and applying crisis management strategies. It was also suggested that solidarity through upkeeping communications was important and that members could embark on joint fundraising to support local resource response plans, and networks-based support was requested. Finally, one member felt members could work together to explore new technology to enable them to support families at a distance in meaningful ways. So to date, how has family reacted to those requests for support? So the first thing is that as of last week, we launched the Emergency Response Fund, and we've already received 15 applications. So this is a small funding opportunity to support members who want to undertake a response to family care issues with support up to £10,000. We're also looking to develop a community platform, so much more of an interactive platform to enable learning and exchange, support and solidarity, and access to a range of different resources. So we're establishing that now, and we'll let you know when that's being launched. We're going to undertake our kinship care campaign, but we're now looking at that through a COVID lens, particularly the whole issue about how kinship care could be both increased in demand for it, but also how it could be more at risk because of the issues of increased risk of health issues for elder grandparents. We are also building a case study saying that this is an excellent opportunity to demonstrate how local civil society organisations are able to respond in an emergency. So we put together a funding proposal to a range of different donors, and if that comes real, we will be, and it gets funded, we will undertake an evaluation of how our members can demonstrate that as local civil society organisations, they are able to respond in an emergency. We're also launching communications, both from members. Many of you have sent us some excellent material to support communications and done video calls and things like that so that we can actually communicate to people about the situation on the ground. And we're also going to launch an opportunity on guidance for how children can also be part of those communications. We're developing statements on particular issues. So the first statement that's gone out is the impact of COVID-19 on children on the move. And we're developing policy briefings, the first one being on kinship care and COVID-19, and sharing technical resources on a regular basis. For those of you that are in the same countries as Child Protection and Humanitarian Response clusters, so at the moment we understand that there are 10 countries where UNICEF and INGOs have set up humanitarian responses where there is a child protection cluster. We've contacted each of you. Please do, if you're in that country, contact them, because you can then be part of the funding that's supporting emergency responses. There are currently 10 countries, but they are looking to expand that, and we will keep you updated on that. And we're also going to arrange training for anybody who's interested in the training that comes from the Alliance of Humanitarian Child Protection in Humanitarian Circumstances. And they will be providing training for all of you who are interested during the first week of May. We will be organising a virtual forum in October. And we are encouraging you, please, to think about also not just about projects that respond directly to COVID-19, but also looking at some potential projects that we could develop between members and look for additional funding for in terms of both response and recovery. For example, there may be projects that people are interested in developing in looking at how one addresses violence in the home or responding to trauma. But if you do have ideas that you'd like to develop, please let us know so that we can develop those into funding proposals to take forward. So there are four panelists today. So the first one is John Turberville, who's the Chief Operating Officer and has previously been the Director of the Mulberry Bush School since September 2006. His responsibility is to support and develop the range of services offered to advance the education, training, research and treatment for emotionally troubled and traumatised children, young people, adults, their families and communities. John made the career move to therapeutic childcare at the Mulberry Bush in 1993. Our next panellist is Tesefe Ebubui, and he is a programme officer at Forum on Sustainable Child Empowerment in Ethiopia. Tesefe is responsible for the design, implementation, monitoring and evaluation of child development, community development, and educational development programs and projects. With over 10 years' experience in the area of humanitarian development fields, he has a strong understanding of appropriate integrated community-based development programs and projects in different regions of Ethiopia, and he's currently studying for his PhD. Iftikhar Ahmed in Bangladesh has been working with the Center for Services and Information on Disability since 2005. As a director of CSID, he manages all projects for the most vulnerable children and adults with disabilities. The work focuses on enhancement of their empowerment and self-development by providing necessary skill training, education, medical support, advocacy to raise awareness of their rights with the aim of rehabilitation into mainstream education and employment. And finally, but not least, Deep Pukasha has been working with boys and young men on gender equality and masculinity since 1997 through Prajak, of which he is the founder director. His work has been primarily focused on children, especially boys in difficult circumstances, including itinerant children in contact with the railways and children in institutions. He currently works with young people in 12 districts to set up youth collectives that campaign for gender equity and intervene during situations of gender discrimination and violence, including child marriage, child trafficking, and child sexual abuse. So I'm now going to open it up to our panelists to just in 5 minutes give us an overview of the situation in your country, what's happening for your organisation, and some examples of your responses. So first of all, John, could I turn to you first, please, if you could just give us a sense of what's happening for Mulberry Bush in the UK.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon, everybody. So the general context in the UK, particularly in England, is that we've had a lockdown due to the coronavirus since mid-March. And that's really been putting in a policy of social distancing for the vast majority of the population. And mostly people have behaved well in relation to the request to socially distance. That's meant everybody staying at home, apart from essential workers, and schools have largely been closed. Although they have been requested to remain open for vulnerable children and the children of key workers, so key workers being our frontline staff. The take-up of those places in schools that remain open has been lower than hoped and expected, and there is some concern about that. Across the country, there's been very little testing offered in relation to COVID-19, and so it's very unclear the level of infection across the population, but that has now been extended beyond the National Health Service, and it's now currently available in the care sector, so in care homes, residential schools, and schools for those showing symptoms and their families. Since the beginning of the lockdown, shops, apart from essential shops, have been closed. And although there initially was some panic buying, that seems to have settled, and now the population is generally getting used to the experience of queuing for their shopping. In relation to the Mulberry Bush, guidance from government was fairly slow to start with in England, and we had a case of a child with symptoms quite early on before guidance came out, and that resulted in us eventually getting some guidance and sending home that child and all children and staff who'd been in touch with that child. That left us with a group of 9 children remaining at the school who went into self-isolation for a 14-day period with a group of staff who volunteered to live on the site for 14 days. Thankfully, we have no further infection amongst that child group or the staff group. And we are just now in the process of bringing the other children back into the school. Although we've completely changed the model of practice, they're coming back into 3 larger groups rather than the 4 original groups. And that really is to try and run the 3 groups as separate mini communities to stop cross-infection between across the child group and between staff members within the staff group. So we're just in the process of doing that. At the moment, we still have no further infection with coronavirus in the child group or the staff group. But it's fair to say there's quite a higher degree of anxiety that we're managing throughout the children and staff. Thank you.
Tesfaye, can I ask you to just give us some input now from Ethiopia and the Worker Forum?
Thank you for your presentations and presentation. Ethiopia, like the other countries in the world, is overwhelmed by this global challenge, COVID-19, since the first case was confirmed in March 13. To date, 16,343 laboratory tests conducted, and there are 130 confirmed cases, and 58 recoveries and 3 people dead. Of course, our testing capacity is really very limited, and it is 136 people per 1 million people, so that is really significantly very low in terms of the total population of the country, that is around 100 million. Right after the occurrence of this pandemic, both the federal and the regional government of Ethiopia took different measures to prevent the spread of the pandemic. This includes the Council of Ministers declared state of emergency in Ethiopia for the coming 5 months. The Ethiopian airline also suspended flights to 80 countries. And Ethiopia also closed land borders and deployed security just to halt the movement of people around the borders. And the prisoners granted pardon, both from the federal general attorney and the president, thousands of prisoners granted pardon. And the different regional governments took their own measures to the spread of the virus. For example, regions of Amhara and Tigray declared state of emergency for 14 days each, and they restricted travel, and some of the cities in these regions were also in a total closure. However, all measures taken by both the federal government, the regional government, and the other pertinent stakeholders working to halt the virus, we have observed that there is lack of behavioral change among the community in terms of preventing the spread of the virus. For example, in terms of social distancing, in terms of properly applying and using the precautions, preventing mechanisms, there is a shortage in terms of behavioral change. When we see the overall impact of this pandemic in Ethiopia, especially at national level, there are economic, social, and political impacts. In terms of the economic impact of the pandemic, for example, there is a continuously rise in the living standard of the people, and there would be a fluctuation in getting exchange rates, so that the level of remittance will also be very discouraged, and even the flower plantation is also devastated as a result of the pandemic. The flower plantation is one of the ways of foreign exchange in Ethiopia. The other one is the ECA estimated at around 2.9%. Will be shaved off from the economic growth that is expected in 2020. In terms of the impact of the pandemic on education, around 26 million students are now out of school due to school closure, and around 1 million students lost their access to school feeding in Ethiopian schools. And yet, this 1 million students lost their access to school feeding. And in terms of the political pandemic, the national election that was scheduled to be conducted on August 2020 is postponed. So that is really one of the political impact of this pandemic. And in terms of our intervention, especially Forum on Sustainable Trade Empowerment, is doing a lot just to contribute in the prevention of the expansion of the pandemic. For example, we have been introducing some form, for example, working in terms of our means of transportation, especially at the end of the level. We are working in shift systems, different information packages, IEC and BCC materials were also produced and distributed to the frontline staff members, the community members. Orientation has also been provided for our staff members. It was at the head office and the frontline staff members. And we are also trying to make collaboration with other pertinent stakeholders at national level just to support the prevention of the spread of this pandemic. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's really interesting. Deep, could I turn to you now and ask you to give us an update on the situation in India and particularly in Kolkata for Praja?
Thank you, Amanda. And we are in the 37th day of the world's largest lockdown in India due to the pandemic. And about 40 million children in India have actually been affected from various strata. Disease-wise, we are not sure how well we are doing. We have more than 20,000 cases of COVID. We have about a 3% rate of succumbing to that. And so far, we have only 20% have recovered. So I think we will go in for a larger lockdown as far as, information is coming in from the government. So the second phase of lockdown might get into another phase of lockdown till May. And as I said, 40 million people, children have been actually impacted. And we are part of this Childline network in India, which is an emergency helpline service for children. And there has been a huge spike in calls, almost 50% spike in calls all over India. And with about 30% of these calls about violence. So there is a lot of increasing violence, but we think this is underreported because even in the best of days, children do not sometimes have access to telephones to even call up the helpline, which is actually toll-free. So, and now when they are actually hemmed in within the four walls, it will be even more difficult. We find it's going to be more difficult for them to get hold of a telephone, if especially the perpetrator, somebody, an adult inside their homes. What we have done is, because most of the SOS calls have been related to food, there has been a lot of SOS calls related to immunization with parents, one really worried about immunization of their children around influenza and tuberculosis. Besides violence, there have been also lots of reports about anxiety among children. There's also been a huge demand of sanitary napkins, because in spite of sanitary napkins being declared as essential services, which are on in India, there doesn't adolescent girls don't seem to be having enough in the shops. So that's another area that there's been a lot of demand for happening. And in India, there's been a 95% spike in in searching child's porn on the internet. So we are all very worried about what impact that can have on children. Most of the children who are in very difficult circumstances are either belonging to families of daily wage earners and of migrant laborers who've taken a major hit. Migrant laborers have been traveling for kilometers, from 1,000 kilometers from one state in India to other just to reach home. Many have died, including children, in the process. Another group of young people who are being really affected are also belonging to the extreme minorities, especially tribal and children and those in forests living in forest areas, and there is also a digital divide which is emerging with schools closed. We have the better non-governmental private schools in cities conducting classes over the internet, but huge numbers of children who are in rural areas and especially the poor are not being able to access. So we fear a lot of dropouts that may actually happen immediately after the lockdown is lifted. And because of the informal sector taking a big hit, we think that there will be a lot of children who will be pushed into labor. But we have worked with the government in our state, and we have been able to declare childline and child help services as emergency services. So that is a silver lining that we and many others like us, relief workers, are able to travel freely and also have access to relief commodities. The other thing is also about stigma. Is there is a lot of stigma that is now happening with those who are being affected by COVID. Neighborhoods are actually not allowing them to return, especially if you're a relative of an affected person, which includes a lot of children. They're being driven, in some places, even in cities like Calcutta, being driven out of their houses. So that's the other area that we are looking at. There are already homeless children on the streets who are suffering, and we have been able to, of course, provide shelter to some of them through our childline services and the government. But one of the big questions is about how do we tackle stigma? Thank you.
Deep, thank you very much. Very thought-provoking, covering a lot of issues that I think will resonate with many of our members. And now is the challenges for all of us to think how to address this really quite depressing and challenging times. If Dikar, could I turn to you now and ask you to give us some insights into what is happening in Bangladesh?
Really, in Bangladesh, the coronavirus pandemic started from March 2020. Until today, 7,103 confirmed cases. And today, the government confirmed 640 corona cases. That is the highest number. And you know, the highest confirmed cases found in Dhaka city, where there are huge people. And one thing I need to share that Bangladesh is a very densely populated country where 160 million people live in this country. That's why sometimes social distance maintenance is very difficult for us. And the office and school definitely close from 20th March, and maybe it will continue till May. And definitely daily income earners in the city are suffering a lot, especially the rickshaw puller, the street vendors. And you know, Bangladesh depends on the garment sector. And in this pandemic situation, most of the garments are closed now. That's why the economical condition is decreasing day by day. And average income in the slums of Bangladesh poors are 80% decrease, and they are suffering a lot. Though the Bangladesh government declared some packages to overcome the situation. And we are working for the most vulnerable children with disabilities. They are most vulnerable because of this pandemic situation. And we are working for the slum children with disabilities, and food is very essential for them at this situation. And though government are providing so much information regarding safety nets and other issues, but lack of information and inaccessible information, some hearing and speech and autism people cannot receive these types of information. And in field level, you know that children with disabilities, most of them need some therapeutic intervention and medical support. But because of this situation, the community workers cannot go to the field. And that's why the children with disabilities cannot receive these types of supports. That's why their physical condition are decreasing day by day. And definitely children with disabilities are more vulnerable in all types of abuse, including sexual abuse. And there are some girls we have found that they already abused because of this pandemic situations. And some children with disabilities who rely on the support of their family members, but now the family members cannot support them. That's why they're suffering a lot, because they cannot continue their toileting, washing, and eating, and other activities. And definitely there are some hygienic materials is there, but because of physical accessibilities, some children with disabilities cannot use these types of hygienic materials. And definitely as an NGO, we are suffering a lot. Most of our project activities are hampered now. And most of the donors advised us to change the present project into corona-focused project, which is very difficult for us in this situation. And financial transaction is very complicated in Bangladesh now, because most of the banks are closed now. And people, even we are suffering a lot. The staff of CSID cannot go to the field. That's why the children are suffering a lot. Though we are monitoring through virtually or through using mobile, but most of the children with disabilities and their family has no internet facilities. That's why we are facing very challenge. And definitely as an organization, we have some responsibilities to this field and to the children with disabilities. That's why we are revising our project into corona-focused project. We are trying to contact virtually, regularly. We are providing some relief and sanitizer to the children with disabilities, and create some linkage with the government and non-government organizations as they can give some relief to the children with disabilities. And, you know, because of this pandemic situation, some children with disabilities have become traumatic. That's why they need psychosocial support. We have some occupation therapists who regularly providing psychosocial counseling through internet and through mobile. And we are providing counseling support to the children through mobile and through internet. Even sometimes our field staff go to the field with proper protection, and we are still suffering. I don't know what will happen after 2 or 3 months. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you to all four of the panelists for raising some really interesting experiences from the different parts of the world. I just wanted to start off, if I may, the privilege of being a moderator, as you can be one of the first ones to ask a question. And Deep, I wonder if you could explore with us a little bit more this whole issue of the very poorest communities migrating from an urban to a rural setting, because my expectation is that what's going to be the impact of those rural communities who are already struggling, then having the families who presumably were the ones who were actually sending back cash to those rural communities originally through their earnings, but are now going to go back to be requiring additional support in those vulnerable communities already. I wonder if you could explore a bit more of what you can see going on in terms of this unusual movement from urban to rural.
Yes, there is this movement that is happening. There will be more movement after the lockdown is lifted in certain areas. India has now been divided into red, orange, and green zones. So possibly after 3rd of May, restrictions will be lifted in green zones. We are also hearing that the government might arrange for railway trains to allow a lot of migrant laborers who've stuck in different parts of India to go back home. In one of the villages, for example, where we work, it's a small village, but there are 250 people who are outside the village now. And there are two challenges for them. One is, of course, what's going to happen to them after that and their families. But the first challenge I was talking about is about stigma. Even the villagers are sometimes saying that they don't want them here. So trying to organize village level quarantines for them according to you know, the government guidelines that we have for 14 days, 21 days, will be a very, very big challenge right in the beginning. And then, of course, there are issues of livelihood, because they, because depending on where they have been working and whether those work areas are red zones, which most of the cities in India are, they might just not be able to go back. There is a limited direct benefit transfers, cash transfers that are happening via a specific COVID-related government project, but that does not have full coverage. So this is about rupees 1,000 Indian rupees per month coming into zero balance accounts. But a lot of people do not have these zero balance accounts, so it's not like everybody is actually getting these cash transfers. But some of this cash transfers might help. But I think we have to look to a big season, at least up till October or November, till the economy starts coming back to the normality of food being one of the very, very big challenges that we have to ensure through our public distribution system and otherwise. So that's a very big challenge that's happening with a lot of migrant populations. Yes.
Very interesting. And Deep, I know that one of the things you also raised was particularly marginalized communities. You were talking about the tribal communities who were actually having to move out and were then made particularly vulnerable because they don't have access to food.
Yes, a lot of these minorities, especially nomadic tribes and itinerant tribes, they have over the last few years lost a lot of their livelihoods. For example, one of the tribes, the largest one that we are now working with, used to be collecting honey. Now, because of environmental changes, there is less and less of bees around many of the places, and they have lost their livelihood and they have been reduced to begging near railway junctions and bus stands and stuff. Because begging actually depends on the economy running and people actually giving it to them. They have totally no food to have. There are also itinerant communities who travel from one religious fair to the other selling folk medicine. They also have nothing with them. There is nobody with them. Nobody has even bothered to get them into the public distribution rationing system. Though the government has now declared that even if you're not part of the rationing system, we will give you coupons to collect the food that we're giving you. But many of them have been so much out of the government system that they do not know how to reach out to the coupons. So we have been actually trying to bridge that gap, I would say, talking to the district administrations and ensuring that rations reach them. But even now, as I said, 37 days into lockdown, rations are not reaching them regularly. And sometimes it's not in the same quantity that they actually require. Many of them are still going hungry. Another very important group, which sort of has fallen by the wayside, have been transgender persons in India. Many of them actually participate in a lot of folk theatre as female impersonators. And since all cultural activities have been banned by the government of India, and we hear that this has been going to be any public, cultural and religious activities where a lot of gathering happens, where they actually tend to perform, have been banned, they have actually lost their livelihood. And they have anyway been among the poorest of the poor. And so this is the other group which is really suffering. So I think the story is actually also about the marginalized communities. And of course, there are a lot of homeless children who are otherwise on the streets, who have their own livelihoods, who had created their own support structures along with adults. They've co-created these structures. They are also facing huge problems because of this loss of livelihood.
Deep, thank you. And I think let's build on that, because we have a couple of questions here for Iftikhar, and this whole issue of us really being very conscious of those groups that are more marginalized and more vulnerable. Iftikhar, there's a couple of questions here for you about children with a disability.
Yeah.
So the first question is, how are you able to support children with a disability who cannot access any of the online platforms due to their conditions?
So, yeah, yeah, Definitely, most of the children with disabilities whom we are working, they don't have internet facilities or online platform. That's why we mostly use telephone or mobile phone.
Okay, and that's working, is it? Are you managing to get sufficient access through mobile technology?
Yeah, actually, the children whom we are working, most of them are very poor. Mm-hmm. And in that area, the internet facilities is also not so good. Mm-hmm. That's why most of them use telephone or mobile phone. Yeah, that's why our main communication is through phone.
Thank you, Iftikhar. And there's another question is, in Bangladesh, is the government provided permission to visit the field to NGOs using preventative measures? So you're getting permission. Is that the have you got the same process as DEEP in that you're declaring yourselves as an emergency service, or how are you doing that?
If we need some emergency service, we definitely need permission from the government. And after the permission from the government, we definitely go to the field. And the NGO people who are working, especially social works in the field, government are very quickly give them permission if they send some proper logic or something like that. And definitely, we need proper protection if we want to go to the field.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask Tesafe, could you tell us a little bit more about the situation for street-connected children and how you're offering them support at the moment and what the situation is for them?
Yes, Amanda, thank you. We are working with children, specifically with our project, Zerbad Destitute project, that is termed as direct services to street children. That is really supported by the World Bank through the Ministry of Social and Labour Affairs. We have been working with the reintegration of street children with the very reintegration guideline of Family for Every Child, and we were to reintegrate effectively these children before the occurrence of this pandemic in Ethiopia. However, now we are working with these children. Our work still continues, and we are really very challenged with providing psychosocial services and other comprehensive protection services for these children. This is just because we are really worried about the congestion. The spread of the pandemic may be occurred in shelters as a result of congestion. So our actual capacity in our temporary shelters is up to 200 street children. We are now serving 57 children. We have reunified 20 children with their families with a proper health care for their health status. However, the government is really taking a risky measure that enhances the number of institutions in Ethiopia. We are really working with the institutionalization, however, for the health of the other street children have been picked up by the government from the street and they have been accumulated in the shelters. And I think it is a risky that may enhance different problems. For example, the rate of abuse, exploitation, and violences may be exacerbated in these institutions that have been built by the government. So these children are really in danger during this pandemic in Ethiopia. And we are closely working with the government for us to prevent the spread of this pandemic, especially at institutional level. Thank you.
Thank you, Tesafe. Tesafe, could I come back to you about another area where we're conscious that this could be really problematic, and as an alliance we should be developing a real position on, and that is the whole issue of kinship care, because I know that Forum has been involved in the research that we've done at a national level on kinship care. But clearly in these situations, one is that there's a likelihood to be an increase in the use of kinship care as children, as you yourself were saying, as children are being moved off the streets. Well, where are they being placed, potentially in kinship care? As Deep was raising, that children, that families are going back to rural communities, and therefore that's going to be a part of kinship care. But the other side of that is obviously that the vast majority of kinship carers are grandparents, and therefore those are the ones who are most likely to be impacted by the illness itself. So I wondered to what extent you were seeing any impact on kinship care coming into vision here in Ethiopia, and what you anticipate might be the situation.
Yes, Amanda, we have conducted a scoping study at national level as part of a global study on kinship care. And we have really understood the dynamics of kinship care in Ethiopia. And we have been using the findings of the research just to design new interventions for addressing the issues of kinship care in here in Ethiopia. And we are also working group at regional level so as to address this issue. And yet, in this challenging time, the pandemic has also its own very impacts on children in kinship care and the caregivers. Its impact can be seen in multidimensional ways. For example, in terms of the economic status of the kinship care givers, it really devastates their livelihood and means of incomes. As a result of the state of emergency, and as a result of the total closure of some of the towns out of the capital, the livelihood and income of the caregivers has been very distracted. And as a result of this, there is a shortage of food and meal service at household levels for the kinship caregivers and those for the children. And there is also a social distancing problem among the kinship caregivers, so that children are also exposed to the pandemic and the virus as a result of this. And the living standard is really rising so that the economic status of the family and the community in general is really hampered. And the other one is in terms of education. Even if we appreciate school, homeschooling, the poorest and the vulnerable children, including children in kinship care, are not really taking advantage of homeschooling. This is just because the Ministry of Education has been providing education through television. They have already started it. And yet, children in kinship care have not the opportunity to access television. And hence, there would be inequity in terms of schooling, and the school dropout may also be one of the very outcomes of pandemic and school closure. And the other ones, in terms of child protection, has also a devastating outcome. For example, that means domestic violence has been increasing from day to day, both are working with and in the regions, so that labor exploitation, sexual exploitation, corporal punishment has also been exhibited in the different communities where we are working with against children in kinship care. And the other one is in terms of sanitation, in terms of hygiene, and in terms of their access to well-managed drinking water, there is really a problem. In Ethiopia, almost 89% of children are deprived of their rights to access sanitation, hygiene, and safely managed drinking water. So this also fuels the problem. And children in kinship care are also part of this problem. And I think these are the overall impacts of the pandemic was on the children in kinship care and kinship caregiver. So like the findings of the research, there is a need of those material and material resources just to enable the kinship caregivers to fulfill the protection needs of children in kinship. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Deep, I have a question for you. It says that you mentioned about the rise in reporting of cases through Childline. Would you be able to share further about these cases, obviously not the specific cases, but in general, and if these and how are these cases being responded to in the COVID situation? So I wonder if you could give us some more insights into so what's coming through in terms of the Childline and how you're able to respond to that in this situation.
Most of the phone calls are around food and immunization. There is a lot of phone calls which are coming around anxiety that children are going through, a lot of stress that they're going through. In the beginning, a lot of children who were going to school and who did not have school actually were a little happy, you know. But I think as this is going on and on, they're getting very really nervous. And so there's a lot of online counseling that is happening. And if the frontline person who's working and who's receiving the phone call thinks that this has to be escalated, then there are already some specialized helplines set up by the Children's Commission that we have in different states and other places and other NGOs. They are being referred to there. And in cases of violence against children, a lot of this violence is also similarly happening with their mothers. So that is something that we are finding it really difficult, because where do we, which, what is the safe shelter that for children? In a certain district in India, of course, they have developed a new approach to this. If there is a complaint on domestic violence, then the perpetrator is actually being taken away and kept in an empty quarantine center instead of the victims being removed from home. So that has been, you know, a sort of a off-the-cuff response by a lot of district administrations. But beyond being able to counsel and beyond the police just making these visits to these homes where these complaints are coming from, at the moment, there is very little else that we are being able to do.
Okay, thanks, Deep, very much. That in itself is helpful insights. And I'm going to add to that, because although John's connection has gone down, Karen, thank you, you've actually provided what you think he might have said. So I'll just read out this, that I expect the children exposed to domestic violence during this period of time may present as unusually withdrawn or unusually more violent. The difficulty is that with the level of trauma in society due to COVID-19, it's difficult to tell whether this is due to domestic violence or community trauma in a way that is so crucial. And I suppose the best thing is to notice with children how they are presenting, acknowledging with them that they seem upset, etc. Use hand puppets and other non-verbal ways to communicate. Karen, thank you. And I think this is something that we will be developing more and more, and may well be one of the really important contributions that the members will have, is in sharing resources and support in terms of how we're going to address this issue of the increase in violence that seems to be happening consistently across the globe because of lockdown. So I'm hoping once we set up the community platform, I imagine that this will be one of the areas where we can really get some, not only some really good discussions going, but also identifying some solutions and sharing some resources to take that forward. Blessing, I noticed there's also a question from you. So your question is, usually the most vulnerable households are located in very remote, hard to reach areas, and most of them do not have access to digital equipment such as phones, TVs and radios. How are you reaching these households during the current lockdown? I think I'll pass that to Deep first, but maybe Tessa Fay may also have a response.
We have actually mapped out from existing information as to where we can find such people, mostly concentrated near railway stations. and in areas where we have just had religious fairs before the lockdown. And wherever we have child lines, we have actually reached out to those areas, mapping out and trying to find out. And therefore, we have been able to reach out to them, sort of guessing as to where they could possibly be.
Tesfaye, did you want to talk about reaching out to really marginalized rural communities?
Yes, Amanda. Of course, by now, even if the state of emergency is still in place, there is no town or city or rural area which is a total closure. Therefore, we are serving in six area program offices, for example, in Bahar Dar, Desi, Koidua, Walaita, Saddu, Addis Ababa, and Dredwa. So we are now working with these communities, especially in our time. However, it is clear that especially those people who are in really far rural areas are not getting information with regard to what the nature of the pandemic is and the precautions, preventive mechanisms which need to follow up. So even some of the urban people are traveling to the most rural areas where they may not be exposed to the pandemic. Especially those people from urban areas are traveling to the monasteries and the churches in the most rural areas. Yes, they thought that the pandemic may not be spread up to the farthest areas of the country. So that's really a very challenging.
Tesfaye, thank you very much. Karen, you said, John, you're back online. I wonder, which is great. Shall we have another go at seeing if you can give us some insights into how you think members should be considering responding to the situation in terms of increased exposure to traumatic experiences?
Yes, thank you. I hope that it's a bit clearer now. Yeah, I was grateful for Karen to provide the answer to the previous question. I suppose I just wanted to add that I think one of the things that we found at the Marlborough Bush is it's really important to both try to keep some things the same whilst acknowledging to everybody that things are going to be and feel very different. We've certainly tried to limit cross-infection by thinking carefully about staff changeovers and shift patterns. But I think probably most important is just talking with the children in very simple language about COVID, about what social distancing means, and exploring theirs and staff's anxieties at a level that's appropriate for the children. We've also found making podcasts with the children very helpful and sharing those with staff and children, and that's really allowed them to think in a way that is helpful to others about the impact of the trauma that they're experiencing around COVID and what they're hearing in the news and in social media. I suppose what's really important is supporting staff at this time to manage their own anxiety and to try and hold that within the staff team so that that doesn't sort of overflow or spill into the child population and the child group. And in that sense, running reflective groups we found very helpful for children, running reflective groups for staff and then children and staff together to think, talk and share their thoughts, fears and anxieties. And then interestingly today, I think one of the, in some ways, the most important thing we've been recognising is that communicating and being in touch with others so much through online experiences like this tends to limit opportunities for fun and laughter and play. And we've been talking quite a lot over the last couple of days about how we find that and that looking different when it's virtual in this way, but really trying to make sure that staff can, adults can have fun and they can have fun with children and that children can have fun and feel that that's okay. I hope that's helpful.
No, that's really very helpful and great insight. And I'm sorry because I'm going to persist with the rather difficult conversations rather than moving into to some light-hearted perspectives on
it. No, absolutely important. Yeah.
But no, point taken, absolutely. Iftikhar, I wondered if we could just refer to one other community that I know you don't necessarily directly work with in Bangladesh, but you will have insights on, and that is the Rohingya refugee community and what's happening there in Cox Bazar, because what we're aware of in different parts of the world, that the obviously refugee communities are in very dense communities in refugee camps, and having far less access to health support and things. I wondered what the situation was there in Bangladesh.
Though we are not working with Rohingya refugee people, but there are huge risks in this Rohingya community people, because there are common places where each day most of the Rohingya people go for water, go for food. And still some of the areas they need to go frequently. And though still there is not huge infection we found, but recently ILO conducted research regarding Rohingya refugees and this pandemic. They find out that maybe the Rohingya people will be a huge risk if the government cannot control their situation in present.
One last question, and that back to you, John. I think it's really interesting to explore, particularly for members who are working with children who have been in residential care but have then gone back to their families or gone back to a family placement. And you were mentioning that for Mulberry Bush, several of your children did return home to a home environment. How have you managed to maintain a connection with those children while they've been outside of Mulberry Bush? And how have you managed to prepare them for returning to Mulberry Bush? Because those transitions in themselves can be very disruptive to a child. And some insights on that, I think, would be very helpful.
I mean, I suppose the key is regular communication, regular steady communication between the child and their family and those that know and look after them at school. So building that relationship between home and the school setting just has been crucial. So while the children were at home, there was regular contact, sort of daily, every other day, between those people and the home, and then starting to, I suppose, explore what's been the same at home, what's been different, and also help them think and help the child think about what might be the same and what might be different when they return to the school setting, because certainly it is very different at the moment. And I suppose in that way, it's trying to reduce levels of anxiety or fantasy in the children about what they might be returning to. One of the things that's caused quite a lot of anxiety has been that the sort of holiday pattern has been changed here. So it's now expected that children remain at school. They don't go home for the usual breaks at the moment, trying to reduce, I suppose, transitions across the country and limit the possibility of cross-infection. And families have found that very difficult. But I suppose it's working at trying to maintain, when the children are then back at school, the ongoing levels of contact with the family, whether it's through on the phone, as people have mentioned earlier on this event, or through other sort of social media means, through FaceTime or online in other ways. But also writing letters and cards to let the family, to let the child know that they're okay, and the child to let the family know that they're okay.
Great. Thank you, John, very much. I think that's brought us to the end of the question time. So I just say thank you so much to John, Tessave, Deep and Iftikhar particularly, because I know it's extremely late in Bangladesh and it's pretty late, Deep, for you in India, so much appreciation for you staying on late. I just wanted to share a couple of slides on the technical guidance that's been developed by UNICEF, Better Care Network, and the Alliance for Child Protection in Humanitarian Settings, which we contributed to and which we have shared with you all, but I'll just give you the highlights for that. So the technical guidance that's been developed has been built on the basis of the child protection minimum standards throughout. And what the guidance is saying is, first of all, in terms of family strengthening, that it's really crucial to focus on awareness raising, so ensuring that people have accurate information about the virus, about preventative strategies, about the situation that's going on within their communities. To challenge stigma, and I think that each of our presenters have raised the whole issue of stigma here, and I think that's something that we will have to really bear in mind as each of us as organisations working on this thing, is to make sure that we're very cognizant and aware of the potential stigma and discrimination that's coming through. And also looking at issues around positive discipline, psychosocial support, which we've referred to several times here, and also interestingly preparing families for ill health within the family community, so they've already got some contingency planning in place ready for the eventuality of somebody in the family becoming ill if that happened. The other guidance is to develop emergency interim family-based care wherever possible and material support to carers. Now, there is guidance saying to avoid any increase in residential care wherever possible, but also the counterside to that is avoiding rapid closure of residential care. We have heard of some countries whereby those children who are in institutions and large-scale residential care, that the governments have closed those very rapidly, and that as a consequence, some children have been placed back into their homes or in foster care through rapid reintegration. Some have actually gone missing. So I think that there is a really strong sense for those countries who have yet to hit the major crisis. Please be aware of the fact that the rapid closure of residential care has really caused significant problems and issues around children's care and protection. The guidance also emphasises ensuring that standard operating procedures are in place for any reintegration, looking at increasing foster care, increasing helplines, and importantly, exactly as Deep was saying, how important those are and how valuable they are. And it's also a mechanism for local civil society organisations to continue to provide a range of services. And importantly, linked to this is this whole idea that drop-in is actually ensuring that the government places certain types of services as essential, which means that they continue to be supported and that the key workers there are able to continue to provide services, which as Deepa is saying is what they've managed to do through their child helpline. But the guidance is also saying that that can happen with drop-in services for street-connected children. So something to consider for those that are working with street-connected children. And then the other aspects are to identify families where there are increased vulnerabilities, to ensure that services can get to those most in need, to look at virtual decision making so that the situation of case management of children doesn't go on hold. We're hearing that both in country and obviously also to do with unaccompanied children with seeking refugee status, whereby the decision making is put on hold and therefore there's a block to any processes which needs to be addressed. So that for those that can influence those things is to say, could virtual decision making continue, look at ways in which case management can be undertaken, and employing online family group counselling as one of the approaches. Talking to exactly as both Iftikhar and John has raised, is ensuring online connections between children and families, but also looking at education, leisure and well-being activities through mobile technology. Speaking to John's point, let's make sure that there are also really positive things that we contribute to children's well-being through this. But the counter side to that, and that one that was raised by Deep, is that the safe use of technology, because it's certainly being reported in different places that there is a significant increase in child pornography going on during this period. Home visits only if staff can be protected, and drop-in services for street-connected children should include health, protection, education and nutrition. And importantly, really to ensure, and this speaks to street-connected children, that they don't become criminalised just by virtue of the fact that they have to be on the streets despite lockdown it being imposed or curfews being imposed. And that rather than criminalising them, they should be directed to services and helplines. And then the other group that really is seen as potentially really vulnerable is those children who've recently left care and are now probably in a quite precarious situations in terms of their home environment being even more isolated and not having the things in place to enable them to cope with this transition that's going on. So ensuring emergency support, and that's both emotional as well as material support, is provided to care leavers, particularly those who've recently left care. So that brings us to the end. Again, I'd just like to thank John, Deep, Iftikhar and Tesfaye for their fascinating presentations and their very insightful contributions and answering questions. Thank you to everybody who attended. I truly hope that this has helped you to get some insights both into the situation, but also into some of the solutions and some of the ways forward, and to also consider, what does this mean as Family for Every Child as an alliance? What can we be developing as responses? How can we share knowledge and experience between us? What sort of joint actions should we be developing that enable us to be able to really add value and make a positive contribution to families and communities? Because the situation certainly looks like, in most parts of the world, that the situation is going to be far more difficult than any of us have probably worked in previously, and therefore it's really, I think it's more important than ever that as an alliance we come together and enable our members to be all the stronger to be able to undertake interventions directly with children and families and their communities. And very interestingly, I don't know if it's been the case for you, but what we've found is that because international agencies can't travel, their normal emergency response has been quite constrained, because obviously normally it is international staff that are transported into emergencies to undertake the emergency response. And therefore the role of local civil society organisations is all the more important than it is normally in terms of emergency response. And so we'd like to encourage, wherever possible, supporting our members to demonstrate how local civil society organisations are able to be not just the frontline response in emergencies, but also part of the recovery process as well. And on that basis, we will keep you informed about everything that's going on. Please do let us know if the Emergency Response Fund would be of interest. Do let us know of any ideas that you would like to, you think that we could be developing within the Alliance with other members. And in bringing to a close, could you please fill in the closing poll as a part of the evaluation of this event, which is the first of several events we will be doing over in terms of looking at understanding better the situation with COVID-19, and more importantly, how we can develop responses around it. Thank you very much to everybody.